Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 292 featuring my good friend Jeff Muddle, the CEO and founder of CG Architect. I have known Jeff for years and years and years and years and years. One of my oldest technology or industry friends, actually, believe it or not. He is a really cool guy. Obviously, CG Architect is a very well-known website. And it's going, it went through a major, major overhaul, right? Right,
Kristen? Oh, yeah. Big.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Big time, big time, big time. So he did a big overhaul on it and talked about what that's like and how he started and the ideas of CG Architect. And I actually remember the day, I think it might even be the night. It was, I think, a THU where he's like, redoing everything. And this was many years ago. And he had that that idea. And it took him several years to get to where it came out in May. To get it pushed out, but it's a really cool update to CG Architect and the functionality and what it's able to do. So I was really happy to see that. Kristen, what did you think of the podcast?
It was good. I've met Jeff like twice now, I think, and he's such a nice guy. And it was cool listening to like just the whole process of redoing the online website and how he taught like the AI, the new improved AI to like, you know, pick the best images. You guys kind of go into that like, oh, but it's only going to choose images you like. So that was interesting to listen to, but it's amazing. Like he has so many sleepless nights doing it. And then the new subscription and recruitment and content creations. And he kind of talks about that, all the new features. So it's it's awesome. It launched in May of this year. So
yeah, and you're right, you hit on the idea of AI, right? So a big part of what makes that site, as you know, as interesting as it is now, is the AI that he has been training to make that site, you know, basically help it curate itself in some interesting ways, and that is a big deal, and we talk a lot about that and how AI has helped him and how we're going through things. And the implications of what AI curating art really means. So it's kind of an interesting idea to say the least. But I really like I said, I've known Jeff for a long time. He is a super nice guy. It's probably because he's Canadian, but he is. I've met him at nearly every conference back to when we used to have conferences. And in fact, he was one on our 24 Hours of Chaos a couple of weeks ago. So that was really cool to have him on there too. Really, really great to have Jeff on. And like I said, he's been on several times. I think this may be the fifth time that he's been on the podcast.
I think so.
Either as an individual or as part of a panel. So really great to have him coming on board. We have a couple events. We have one event, Kristen. What's going on as an event that's coming up soon?
Yes. So this is, you can find this out at chaosgroup.com/events. And this is kind of like a long running event. So September 17th through October 13th, it's called the Discover the Power of V-Ray 5 series. And so there's going to be just a lot of exclusive presentations from just different parts of the world. All the cool stuff about V-Ray 5 and learn all the different stuff.
Cool. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And we don't have any particular product announcements, but since we are talking about V-Ray 5, we do have V-Ray 5 that's going to start to appear in several other packages and be coming out in betas, either private or public. And usually what we do is we start with a private beta and then it goes to a public beta so that we can broaden it out as we get to certain areas. So those are going to be coming out very soon. So just keep an eye out on all that information, chaosgroup.com, or follow us on social media. We're on Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all the other social media platforms for our product. Now, if people want to find out more about this podcast, where can they go, Kristen?
You can go to facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast or chaosgroup.com/CG Garage.
That's correct. And if you have any ideas for cool stuff that you want to hear on this podcast, different guests or anything of that nature, just let us know. Email us, labs@chaosgroup.com. We have gotten some emails and we have responded to some of those emails as well, as long as we're able to fit it in or we think it's a guest that's going to be a good fit, we will definitely take that into consideration. But we'd love to hear it. Any feedback you have. And I am recording this podcast from a slightly different location. I may be in a different area. I can't go outside like I've done before because Kristen and I are covered in wildfire smoke. And if going outside for more than a few minutes is kind of toxic.
Yes.
So we're staying indoors Sorry if this sounds a little different, but I think it sounds good, right, Kristen?
Yeah.
It should sound good. Yeah.
Sounds fine to me. I love it.
All right. Well, that being said, please enjoy this awesome podcast with our good friend, Mr. Jeff Muddle of CGArchitects.com.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
Does it sound echoey?
It sounds perfect, dude.
Really?
Yeah, it sounds great.
See, so when I monitor, I can hear. It's funny, if you saw the room here, I got like pillows all over my trying to kill the echo in my office. So.
You should see where I'm recording. Are you ready? All right.
Yeah.
It's my kid's bunk bed.
No. That's amazing.
It's perfect. It's like a sound booth.
Yeah. Oh my god, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's been my trick. That's a little behind the scenes, literally.
that's amazing. Yeah.
So that's pretty funny. All right, Jeff. So you may potentially be the most repeated guests on CG Garage.
Is that right? I was trying to think about this. Is this number 4?
It's got to be. I think we've done at least 2 of you, just you and I hanging out in person. And then you and I have been on panels together, at least 2 of those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. That probably adds to the count.
So we're looking at like 4. So this could be the 5th. I'm not sure, but you've been on several times.
Crazy.
But it's been actually a long time since you have been on. And this podcast is coming up on 6 years.
Really? Has it been that long already?
Yeah. I'm wow. almost coming up to 300 episodes.
Damn, that's impressive.
Yeah, I think it is impressive. It's a little bit like jarring to me, but it's actually probably been at least 100 episodes since you have actually been on and told us what's going on with Jeff.
Yeah.
And I know that you had been talking for many years about, you know, what's kind of happened with CG Architect. And now it's kind of been out for a while now. And, I actually want to go through that and see, like, okay, what motivated CG Architect? You know, that was the first time I met you. You were just launching CG Architect. You had this idea back in 2001.
The original site, yeah. That's the year we launched. I think the original idea probably came up in 2000, mid-late 2000, but then it didn't launch until August of 2001.
Yeah, and I was working at Gensler at the time, and you cold called me and said, hey, I'm launching this new thing. Do you want to be involved? And I was like, this sounds really interesting. Yeah. So we became friends since then. I mean, obviously, we meet at like nearly every conference, although that's not happening for a while now. But that site has been, you know, the cornerstone of ArcViz for forever, right? For close to 20 years. But you decided to do a complete redesign, rethinking about it. So let's get a little history. CG Architect, why it got motivated, where it went to, and why you felt it needed to change.
Yeah. So this was back in, I started in 3D probably 95, 96. So I think I'd been in production for 6 or 7 years at the time, and I was getting bored. So I was kind of looking. I mean, I don't know. We've probably talked about this on a past podcast.
But yeah, but people can get a refresher.
So I was getting
previously bored, on Jeff Muddle's previous episode.
exactly. But yeah, no, I was getting bored. So I was curious, you know, what the next opportunities were going to bring. And there were other sites out there for VFX and games, but there was nothing for ArcViz. So selfishly, I wanted to do a little bit of reconnaissance to figure out what else was going on in the industry and where everybody was working. It was such a small industry back then. There wasn't really an easy way to, other than at events, to figure out what was going on. So I thought, well, I'll start this new site. I'll interview a lot of my friends. And more importantly, I'll have a job board. And when the jobs come in, I'll go to apply for them first. Exactly. So, I mean, in a strange
make your own classifieds for yourself.
Exactly. But But in a strange turn of events, every opportunity I've had, both working for others and myself, has been a direct result of CG Architect. So even though I've never actually applied for any of the jobs on the job board in the end, starting the site did end up kind of launching much of what I've done in my career.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it was a very important part, still is, but that during those times of forums were really big then. People were going on there to talk about different things, different renderers, different 3D packages, different ideas. And it was kind of a really big deal. And I think this was also during, especially in the CG part, this was right when the ray tracing render battles was starting with the Brazil and Final Render and V-Ray and Mental Ray. And so it was right at the hot time when people wanted to talk about that stuff, right?
Absolutely. So yeah, I mean, things have changed a lot. I mean, obviously social media has really kind of taken the win from that component, but there's still a huge need to share information and knowledge and the work that's being done in the industry. And I think that's kind of where, one of the reasons that for the rehash of the site, I'd been thinking about, where I wanted to take it for probably about 5 years. So I probably a lot of people had heard me talking about this for a really long time, and it was never coming. But I had all these ideas, and I just didn't really know how I wanted to bring it all together. And I think it would is so this is 2020, so it would have been like 2018. I met with the flew to Portugal. I met with my team over there, Andre's team, from THU, and kind of presented what I wanted to do. And I think at the time the scope for it was probably a 20 or 30 page document. And then I came back and I think
But
that
what motivated you? What you said you wanted to change something about the site. So what was the
yeah
big thing about it?
so I mean, I think what happened is, I was the first with the original site, but then you ended up getting a lot of people that just sort of were either replicating that on social media or just full out copying what we had done. And I wanted to do something a little bit different and something that was a little bit more robust. So really we've moved from being just a website to a full-blown application. I mean, we even have subscription plans for it now because there's so many features. I mean, there's AI powered stuff, there's a whole recruiting platform. It's like Pinterest and LinkedIn and Behance all kind of mashed together in one. So it does a lot of stuff that the old site couldn't do. So it's kind of just the impetus for the new site was really to try to do something that wouldn't be easy for others to do, and but also addressed a lot of the needs of the industry. After I had met with the developers, I think I went to London in January, and I went and visited 16 or 17 different studios in a week, and sat down with them for an hour and a half each, and told them what my ideas were, and then I took a lot of their feedback and ended up using that to refine what the scope for the whole site would be. And in the end, the kind of 50,000 foot scope document that I gave over to Andre's team was, I think, 80 pages, and that didn't even go into the details. But it took a solid year of development to get it done. So,
Yeah, so it was a complete redesign of the site, which is
yeah, we kept
clear.
nothing other than the back, other than the actual database of images and the data that was associated with it. There's nothing that stayed.
Right. The URL is there, so.
Yeah, exactly. Even some of those changed.
That's true. That's true. But it was a kind of a big deal. And, I remember that moment. I think it was at THU, the moment where he's like, I'm going to redo everything. It's a reset in a lot of ways. And I think it was really kind of interesting that that's what sort of got that got that going. You were obviously frustrated with, like, the site had been duplicated and replicated, and it just wasn't right, and you felt like you needed a new look and a new thing. And that's actually not a bad thing. That's a good inspiration,
I mean, I guess competition is the inspiration for
for progress,
progress.
Right?
So
that's a good thing. So tell us about, like, what CG Architect, what the new CG Architect has to offer, because you said it does do a lot, but let's get into some details about some of that stuff.
So I think one of the things I'm probably most proud of is the AI implementation, to be honest.
Explain that.
Yeah, so I mean, there's many different facets behind the scenes that are using AI, but the one that I'm most proud of is the aesthetics prediction engine. So one of the problems that all community sites have, especially when there's user-generated content, is you have this fire hose of information that's coming in. And 1 minute, especially if you're going to feed that to a homepage in a chronological order, one minute you'll come to the site and it might look amazing because somebody uploaded a whole bunch of work, or they unfortunately maybe upload 50 images and all of a sudden the homepage is flooded with one artist. The other downside is what happens when mediocre work or really poor work gets uploaded to the site, and now your homepage is flooded with work that isn't inspirational and it's not going to attract or incentivize anybody to go deeper in the site. So, and then your brand is also associated with that. So it's problematic. So without
So there's curators normally that do that. That's the old way of doing things.
Well, exactly. And that's where I was going, is like, you have kind of two options. You can either manually curate all of these images. And in the first month, I think we had close to 5,000 images uploaded. So that's pretty much an impossible task. Or you figure out a way to automate it. And the traditional way to automate, what's good and bad is how people interact with the content, likes, views,
Votes up,
comments, and
vote
that
up,
sort
vote
of thing.
down.
Exactly. But if something's brand new and it hasn't, and it just hit the site, you don't have any of that. So you have no metrics to know whether it's good or bad.
And it gets lost in the not seen category, right?
Exactly. So what I did, I've been doing a lot of research. I probably spent about a year doing research into different techniques to do this, and I'm sure over time I'll refine this. But we already had at the time, I think, around 85,000 images in our database, going back 19 years. So let's leverage it, right? I mean, AI is all about, the machine learning is all about the data you can give to it. So I spent about a month in my evenings, 2 to 3 hours a night, going through and manually tagging images into categories of good, bad, exceptional, really good sort of thing. And then you also using the feedback that had already been given to those images in the past. And then we use that as training data to try to decide, what can machine learning. At first, I didn't know if it was going to work. I'd hoped it would work, but we wanted to see if we fed this data into a machine learning algorithm, could it figure out what the community would consider to be aesthetically pleasing? So I fed this in, and I, ran the AI and out spit these results that would give it a score. We had to do, in the end, we ended up doing a lot of post-processing on the data. So, I mean, that's a little bit of the secret sauce. But in essence, it spits out a score. And we found out that it's about 75 to 85% accurate. People in the industry would consider that image to be a good image. So what's interesting in the last, let's see, it's been about 2 months now that we've been live with the new site, the homepage consistently has good images. It doesn't catch everything, and sometimes it lets some stuff through that probably I wouldn't have, put on the homepage. But we had people in the first couple of weeks saying, like, it's amazing, all of these new images that are on the site that are so good. And I'm like, but they were there for years. It's just that
Didn't see them.
you didn't see them because there was no way to extract them based on quality like that. So, yeah, it's working really, really well.
Well, it brings up some very interesting questions, right? And I'm sure we'll get into this because
Yeah.
did you listen to the Andy Lomas podcast I did with him where he talked about his learning algorithm that he did for
I
picking
did.
things?
I did. Yeah. I was very
Yeah.
curious to see his approach to that, and it was very fascinating. So it was very, it's similar to a lot of the research I had read. It's a little bit of a different take. But his was very complex.
Well, but he's a
Mine's,
scientist.
yeah, of course. Yeah. I mean, I not being a scientist, took a little bit more of a brute force approach, and I wasn't sure if that would work doing that. I think there's definitely some nuance that could be had in the future, and I have some ideas on that. But yeah, my approach is very much brute force.
Well, okay, but you specifically had to do the brute force to deal with the to deal with all these images. He was struggling with what he called like input fatigue, right? You did you experience any of that? That you're like, yes, no, I don't know.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it's really easy to flag bad images. It's really easy to flag exceptional images, but the stuff in the middle, that's where it gets really difficult because it becomes a lot more subjective in the middle.
Well, it's subjective by its own nature, I mean,
The
by
whole process
default.
is, the
The
whole
whole
process
process
is,
is
yes.
subjective.
Yeah.
Do you feel, I mean, so this algorithm is trained by what Jeff likes and then backed up by what your user base has
Yeah.
liked.
Yeah. So yes, I mean, to there is my personal bias, but
it's your site. I mean, of course.
Well, of course. Yeah. there's that too. But I think, you know, 19 years in the industry and understanding intimately what the industry considers to be a good image, I think gives me some, you know, ability to be able to do that.
I'm not questioning that.
Yeah.
Because if your alternative is to manually curate, at which point it'd be totally yours. if you manually cured it, it'd be totally yours. Right. Yeah. So this is just like training an assistant to like the same things that you like.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, it was a lot of my, you know, bias, I guess, you know, in the sense that it was me picking, but based on what I already knew people liked, because I already saw the feedback. I've seen the feedback on the awards, on the existing site, that sort of thing. It's worked out really well. There's still some things I want to do, but that's only just one part of the AI that we haven't implemented. So,
well, it's interesting. So now you have all of these. So people submit images. So you don't have to worry about it. You don't have to curate it as much. It just comes in. You can probably like fix things on the fly. But when you go to CG Architect right now, it lights up. You know, your inspirational section is definitely inspirational.
Right? Yeah, that was the goal. Yeah.
So that's a really interesting idea. And I remember you were talking about that for a long, long time. And I've actually been a judge at least once on CG Architect. And it is very hard to go through the images and the animation and sort of like figure out how to categorize things. I know that when I get it, I'm only down to a couple hundred images, and you have already gone through 80,000 images to put it down to those couple hundreds. So it's really challenging to see that. But yeah, I'm just curious about, like, you know, what have you learned from that process? Obviously, yes, you should be very proud of that and having trained that system. But what have you learned from that that process? What has it done for you besides make your life a little easier?
I've learned that we need to figure out a way to get more exposure for all of the other images. It solved the problem of pushing the best work to the top. Mm-hmm. But now we have this problem where when you get 5,000 and 6,000 images a month, how do you ensure everybody's images get seen?
Right.
Which was an interesting problem, because it was the problem I was trying to get away from. And then in the end, I think I almost in a way made it worse. By doing this, by pushing all of the best images to the top, kind of like the average images that are still good, don't get seen as much. So I have to figure out how I address that.
Well, I'm wondering if there's a way, and there must be. I mean, you've already dived in deep enough into this area for AI to figure out some diversity, right?
Yeah.
Because the thing is, for example, I don't want to pick on it, but if you go to ArtStation, which is a great site, and it's been around for a while, but I look at ArtStation and, you know, I jokingly call it the Chicks with Sword station, because it's all it is. It's just, female cartoon characters with skimpy bikinis and swords is like 50% of the images on that site, on at least the front page.
Yep. Right? They're not using AI currently. They have looked into it because I spoke to Leo about this. Maybe they've changed recently, but they have an interesting problem. I guess they're a little bit different in that CG Architect is a very homogeneous set of content. Our content is always architecture. It's always interior, exterior of some nature. So it's very predictable. Mm-hmm. They have a very, even though their vertical is quite condensed, the type of content that's submitted is very diverse. And anytime you have a diverse set of content, then it's very difficult to train an AI to recognize what is good or bad. So what they're leveraging right now, and because they have so much traffic and it's so many people on the site all the time, it's really easy for them to leverage the likes and comments and shares to push to the top. And by the nature of the demographic, that's the content you've pushed out is what gets pushed to the top.
Right.
You know, in which, you know, they have a curated section as well.
Right.
But yeah, it's a problem for them, I think. How do you deal with that?
It is. And it's also like, why is that the only audience that's there? Right. So that's the other question. It's like, I guess it's an audience that reinforces itself, right? Because the more people like it, the more people like that will go like it, you know? So it's like another thing. to sort of do that. And you're right. Architecture is definitely more subjective, but there is a style now. If I go to, you know, I go to these images up there, and this is not just you, but like, you know, there's a lot of things that obviously a lot of people are inspired by companies like Mir, right? So you see a lot of renderings and they look like Mir style renderings, right?
Yeah.
Or there used to be, you know, Alex Roman or all of those other ones are obviously inspired as well. But I think it's just the way you present things, right? The way you present things are very interesting as well. So
What you just mentioned brings up an interesting point, because our industry is very self-referential. And if you train an AI to say that this set of images, let's put this in the camera, in this set of images is good, how do you find something that is exceptional but doesn't fit within that constraint of what it's learned? And then how does that, you know, get lost? And how does the next, you know, Alex Roman, you know, get lost, for example, on our site if it can't ever be seen? What's interesting, though, is in anytime you feed data into a, you know, at least at my level anyway, without understanding, you really don't know what's going on inside this black box. You feed it data and it spits out its interpretation, its analysis of all of the data and given the constraints you've given it. But what's interesting is it's able to find in this, you know, something a little bit higher level. It's not just looking for like blue images or images that, you know, have a certain line structure or something. It's somehow able to pick up on something a little bit more nuanced. So I feel like in what I've seen it pick, I think it would pick up on a aesthetic and a quality level within an image, even if it didn't fit inside the kind of the original training data.
Right. But if someone, for example, created a really beautiful rendering that was non-photoreal, right?
Yeah.
And using very simple line gestures that was like, wow, your AI will probably not capture that because it's so used to photorealistic CG, right?
So it's interesting you say that, because just this week there was a hand-sketched image that had a very faint photographic background, almost imperceivable. But 95% of the image was a hand sketch, and it picked it up.
Wow.
And I was like, well, how did that show up? Because that's not like anything else that I, not
it was a
single,
good image, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it was cool looking. I don't know how it picked it up. And this is the curious thing about AI is sometimes you just don't know why it's doing certain things.
I almost wish that it took like 10% of the images that it rejected and just say, check these out just in case I got it wrong. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that, you know, will come in the future is right now it's based on an amount of training data in the beginning, but it's not retraining itself right now, but that's a future plan. So based on the whole point of the AI is to put it in one direction or the other, and then we leave it to the community to decide, you know, did we get it wrong? You know, just push it a little bit higher, or let's push it down a little bit because it's not as good as the AI thought. But eventually we'll take that feedback that everybody's given and we'll push that back in and we'll be able to retrain and hone the AI as well.
So if you're getting like 5,000 a month or whatever you're getting on terms of your inputs of your images, what percentage are you saying of those images are getting the higher score, getting the...
And I think because it's... Well, it's a grading, right? So we don't just say, you know, we only pick 10 out of 10 images. It's a gradient, right? Mm-hmm. So everything's pushed up in a gradient.
Yeah.
So as you go down, they get progressively less of a score. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, but like how, if I'm going to like, and then also how old is that image? That's another thing, right? So you want to keep your inspirational things sort of more towards the new, because you could have had something that was really exceptional, but then it ends up on your front page for 6 years or whatever.
So it's a combination of both chronological and score on the homepage currently. But we also have visual search, which is also AI powered. So you can click on, anytime you're on any one of the images, you can click a similar search and it feeds that image up to our AI, and then it will do not a search based on keywords or anything like that, which we also do, but it looks at the the image itself, the pixels themselves, and then it looks for similar images based on kind of its analysis, and then feeds back all of the images. And what's really interesting about that is it will pull up images. I've seen images that were really good from 2008, and it pushed. You know, it's really cool because those features, the visual search, and the search by color and that sort of thing, that are all AI powered. They are really starting to unearth images that, you know, I haven't seen in years, or that I'd never seen at all, because, you know, I mean, we have almost 100,000 images on the site now, so it's hard to have seen them all. But it's curious what you can find. We have like a board section, which is kind of like a Pinterest for ArcViz. So we're seeing people use these visual search tools to try to find inspiration for their new images that they're generating.
Yeah, because you're right. It's not, using that tool not just to pick things, but also to help you find things that are going to get you where you want to be and inspirational where you want to be. Are you noticing since you've launched this, obviously, is your image submission gone way up?
Oh, huge. Yeah, I mean, we had more images submitted in the first couple of months than we had all last year.
When did it officially go up?
We should actually remember this date. I'll have to look back. I was so stressed. I worked 40 hours without sleep on launch day. So, yeah, I think it was May, mid-May.
So right during all of this. So
Yeah.
then you had 2 months of just hardcore image submission, which is great, really, really great. Well, that's really cool. And that's so the main reason for this image submission, well, the main reason you'd want to put your image up on CG Architect is to be discovered, right? So people
Yeah,
can
I mean,
see
I
it.
think that's the reason for most community sites and even social,
Right.
right? Everybody wants to be validated and to have their work commented upon and to,
Right.
know that what they're doing is good
Right. And
or
then,
bad.
yeah, obviously they can get composition questions, et cetera. And the thing is, architects are, or architectural illustrators and archivist people, they are very set in certain way that rules are done, right? So that they're like, I'm sure when you get feedback, it's like, this thing needs to be right here. That line isn't quite straight enough. That thing is like, it's all very, very
Yeah.
specific. So that feedback is going to be pretty good. And obviously, how has the, how have you noticed that specifically, like the community involvement since you've launched a new site? Obviously getting a lot more community comments and support and all of that stuff.
I would say of everything I've done in the last 19 years with CG Architect, this has received the most unsolicited positive feedback of anything I've done. So it's been good. Yeah.
That says a lot because CG Architect, as you mentioned, has always been an incredibly important part of the community, especially in ArcViz, that for a long time. So if that's the case, then that's a significant thing. So great. So now people have a great place they can submit their work that's centered around ArcViz and around architecture and sort of works in a really great way there. What's the other things that you that their site has to offer that you can go through? Because you obviously have subscription areas and different levels of membership that you can do.
Yeah, I mean that allows people to get access to a lot of the AI power features and whatnot. But I think it was kind of the new site was kind of in launched in two sides. One was the community side that people have always known CG Architect for. The other half is a recruiting platform for the industry. Probably not the best time to be launching a recruiting platform into the middle of the biggest non-hiring phase probably in history. But it will come in time. But the whole reason for this, and also for the AI, was over the last 10 years, studios would always come to me because the most senior artists are the most difficult to find. And they would come to me and say, Jeff, we'll give you X amount of money if you can find X person. And I know where the X person is, but I can't go poaching from one friend's company and then, hand him over to another friend.
It's
Because,
a small community.
exactly. I joked with him. I said, I can do that. My fee is going to be $250,000 ahead because I'm going to be out of business in 6 months because nobody will ever talk to me again. So the whole point of this platform was how can I
Or you
have
can't guarantee that I'm not going to do it to you later in 2 months when
right? Exactly. I'm going to go back to another one.
Yeah.
Got 6 months, I'm going to make $20 million. Yeah. No. But yeah, but the whole point was how could I develop a system that would, put me at arm's length, but then still have the same ability to help people find
Right.
the right artists on our industry. And one of the problems that I found with all recruiting sites, even our own previously, they were all text-based. Nobody hires based on text. Everybody hires based on portfolio first. So anytime, you would go to a site where somebody would have, their submission, you had to click a link and then you had to browse a website or open a PDF. So when you got all these
Right.
applications, it was a very cumbersome process, and the wrong information was being put up first. Everybody looks at the portfolio first. If they see something of interest in there or something that piques their, then they'll look into the who the person is.
Right.
But if they don't get past that, then it doesn't work. So what we did is we built a system where, we leverage the community side where we already have all of those images being uploaded, and push those in a way where recruiters can now search through that database with a lot of meaningful data, and then look specifically at the portfolios, and then they can look at all of the other information as well. And of course, we leverage the AI to help, sort that out based on, good images. So if somebody gets in 500 applications, they can, start to filter based on quality and whatnot.
And that's really cool. That's really cool. I think that's an important part of, finding talent. I know that there's a friend of mine who runs a very successful studio, and he's been doing. He likes to personally find artists himself, as opposed to finding a recruiter or getting a recruiter to do it. The recruiter will do the actual finding of the person, but he likes to do it, and he'll just literally just browse ArtStation or whatever he's doing, and like that's like, oh, that's the thing I'm looking for.
And that was the whole, all of the search tools we built are designed specifically for that, because we know that that's how the hiring process happens. I mean, there's recruiters that work in our industry, and I don't think I've spoken to anybody that has ever said, "I had such an amazing experience with a recruiter. I'm so glad I spent that 20% of their first year pay." It's it just it's not. I mean, it makes sense too. I mean, unless somebody is a recruiter that worked in our industry specifically, which is very, very rare, if at all, they just don't know the nuances to be able to find the right people.
It's just ridiculous. I mean, when it, in the VFX world, it was like, I need a person with 4 years experience that has, that knows these programs and that is specializes in, hard surface modeling or whatever. It's like.
Well, this was another thing that we
You just
wanted
filtered
to.
out too many things there.
Yeah, exactly. But that was one of the things that we wanted to address, is how do you allow people to filter for, those very specific people? We've built all these tools to help them do that, really.
Yeah, but I think that sometimes, like for example, there was someone who was asking, it's like, well, I want someone that knows this, 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 and this, right? And then it was like, okay, well, that's all final. It's like, but why are you picking this one thing, which was a program that they need to know, right? And it's
Get a little
like,
bit too
if you
granular,
have all of this, this can be picked up in 2 weeks, and you're making a long-term hire anyway. You've just removed a whole bunch of possibly excellent candidates just because of that
Unnecessarily.
one thing that you picked there. And so it's just, I
One of the
always
other
think it's
big.
like the art is the most important thing. If you can look at the art and then also have a conversation with a person and realize they're not totally insane, then you're in a good position. You know what I mean?
Well, and I think the other biggest challenge in our industry is work visas. And that information is never put up front. So now we actually, it's part of, if you want to put your portfolio online and be found, where you are legally allowed to work is part of the process.
Interesting.
So, because what would happen is someone will be like, "Oh, that's an amazing artist." They go to their find their portfolio. Yep, I'm going to call them up. So now I
Yep,
waste a
based on
bunch of
Sri
time. Exactly, or wherever, right? I mean, they could be based in the US or Canada, but if they don't have the money or the ways to get them over to Europe, for example, then it was a pointless waste of time. So now they browsed them, they looked up their information, they got in touch with them by email, they probably had a conversation with them, and then they find out, "Oh, you don't have a visa." Okay, so that was a waste of time. So now, people can immediately kind of narrow that down.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. Well, the yeah, visas are interesting. What is your thoughts about that? Because I'm noticing it's becoming less of an issue now that everyone's working from home.
Perhaps. Yeah. I do think, though, and there's been some articles that have come out that I've read recently, how people are kind of rethinking whether or not work from home actually works. Yes, it does in some regards, but I think there's this huge component of social interaction that we're missing. You know, those 2-minute conversations that you have during the day and whatnot. I worked for a company in London many years ago and was hired to open up an office in North America. Mm-hmm. And just that time zone separation and the separation, even though, you know, I was at the same level as, the people that were running the offices in Europe, you really take for granted the 30-second conversation that you have in a hallway or at the getting tea or whatever during the day that mm-hmm. in the end actually is critical information that helps you make decisions. But when you have that 30-second conversation, the first thought is not like, oh, I better like start a Zoom meeting and loop everybody in on this 15-second conversation. So a lot of that stuff gets lost. And I think, you know, that I think there is something to be said for having people in offices, you know, when there it's not is, just production.
There is, and there's, and it goes the other way too, right? Because it's way easier to say, hey, let's have a Zoom meeting. And then people from 5 different cities can be in a meeting room like within 15 minutes of you saying, let's have a meeting, right?
Yep.
As opposed to, well, we'll all fly in tomorrow right. and we'll meet for lunch and do like, it's like, ugh, you know what I mean? That is so wasteful if you really think about it.
Sure.
Not only time, but the amount of fuel you're doing for flying and like everything is just really, really bad. So I think that there's a balance between those two things. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, if people learn to check in with each other more often and just go like, hey, hop on a call more often, then it's going to be better. I know I've been loving not dealing with 2.5 hours of traffic every day. So that's been a good thing of not dealing with the LA traffic. But I know that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes you need someone to oversee what you're doing. Sometimes you need other things to happen. So what was that? Oh, someone's at your door.
Yeah, it's all right. I'll just ignore them.
Okay.
I'm looking out my office window and there's this guy standing there and I'm just thinking, oh man, he's going to ring the doorbell. It's all right.
Ding dong. That's all right. It's all right. But anyway, there's that, you know, there is, I think there's going to be some good things and some bad things. I've been actually pretty happy working from home, honestly speaking.
Really?
But you see, the thing is, I've been a one-man army for labs for a long time, so I don't really need to sit there and validate everything with everyone.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and I guess I'm the same, I guess. I personally do really miss the travel though. Not just for the travel, for the sake of travel, but just the interactions with people. I guess, you know, you were fortunate that you know, you still had, people in an office, you know, when you were there. So you were able to
but, you know,
chat with people
in our office. We all sat next to each other and they messaged each other on the computer. They didn't even talk to each other.
Oh, is that right?
And the reason they did that is because they didn't want to have conversations over other people and interrupt them. So it's like, well, they're doing that from home anyway.
I mean,
the social aspect is big.
Yeah. And I think there's something, you know, that you can't get through a Zoom meeting in terms of just facial expressions, like those micro expressions that you can read in person that you can't pick up, you know, in a Zoom meeting, that, you know, are sometimes really key to understanding whether somebody understands you or whether they think it's a good idea or a bad idea. Or I think there's just a lot of stuff that more nuance that you can only get when you're in person. And I think too, in terms of establishing new relationships, especially within business, if this is going to be a prolonged pandemic, which I suspect it will be, I think we're really going to have to rethink how we network in the future. You know, if we can't get together in masses for a while, how do you build trust with somebody? I mean, I know personally for 19 years, every contract I've ever signed has been a result of meeting people time and time again in person. I don't think I would have been able to close many of those deals if it were not for in-person. There's no way that sort of relationship and trust happens through an email or even a Zoom meeting. So, you know, you can, for a little while, you can leverage your existing relationships, but if you're, you know, owning a business, and how do you go about establishing new relationships? You know, at events, you know, you often are going out and socializing in the evenings and having conversations about anything but work. And I think that's probably almost more important than the conversations about work themselves, because you get to know somebody and you get to know, are they somebody that I like? Are they somebody I want to work with? Is it
Right,
somebody that I could envision, you know, doing business with? That, you know, you're not gonna set up a, you know, I'm not gonna call you up and like, hey Chris, you know, can we just schedule an hour long Zoom meeting just so we can shoot the shit? Because it's, I mean, because everyone's gonna be like, yeah, no, I'm busy then, you know, it's nobody's gonna do that. So how do you get that non-business communication? Because at the beginning of a Zoom call, when you have a bunch of people, if you're lucky, there's 5 minutes of like, you know,
Yeah.
of
It
BS
is
in the
weird.
beginning.
Like if you're trying a business and it's like, hey, we should go out for drinks. How about you connect to Zoom at 6 o'clock and we have a cocktail together? You know,
Exactly.
that would be
Exactly.
a little weird.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Maybe
I do
completely
connect with my
normal.
friend, like one of my friends who's moved up in the Bay Area, and I connect with him like 2 or 3 times a week, and we just, you know, at the end of the day, he's having a beer and I'm having a whiskey and we're chatting for like an hour and a half or so. So, you know, that's cool, you know. And we didn't do that before. By the way, we didn't do that before. We barely ever talked. And now suddenly, like, yeah, I guess show me what, you know, he's fixing his trucks. I was like, show me what's going on with your truck, you know. So it's like kind of funny to have that going on.
Yeah. I mean, I consider myself to be a, you know, a bit of a, mostly an introvert, but then, you know, I extreme amounts of extroversion when I travel, I guess.
Yes.
But I don't know. I guess I maybe overestimated how much of an introvert I am, because this even I'm starting to go insane now.
It is I am, well, we're also very fortunate, Jeff, because we have families, so we get to actually hang out with our families. And there's some
True.
people that are all by themselves, and those people are seriously having cabin fever.
Yeah, no kidding.
And so I'm concerned about some of those people. I feel bad for them because some of them are out of work on top of that. So imagine
Yeah.
all you're doing is staying home and watching Netflix all day. That's really hard.
Yeah, right. That would be tough.
Yeah, it'd be really tough. All right, but let's not get too down on ourselves. I
Yeah.
still think that, you know, I still think that there's an interesting thing, right? Because you launched your redesign in May. Obviously, you do have a job section in there, but obviously, you know, that the do you think the archivist community is sort of not hiring right now? Is it sort of put a freeze on everything? Because it's kind of hard to tell where
Yeah.
jobs are coming or not coming.
I think, you know, there are some studios that I see are hiring. You know, we are getting some posts, but nowhere near the volume as before, obviously. I think we're going to see some, you know, uncertainty probably into early next year, to be honest. You know, I think a lot of it is based on the clients. It's not so much on the studios not maybe wanting to hire, or able to hire, but you know, if the work doesn't come in, then it doesn't make a lot of sense to do that. So, you know, and then the clients are holding off and still pausing a lot of things. You know, there was kind of two camps, and I need to do a little bit more research in kind of the state in the last couple of months. But in the beginning, you kind of saw two camps. One was, you know, studios that had really long-term projects, so even they were able to pretty easily weather, you know, the first 3 months, because they had enough work to keep them busy into the midsummer. And then you had other people that, you know, especially the small freelancers, it's really difficult when, you know, you can only do one job at a time, maybe two if you're one person. And if all of a sudden all your jobs go away, you're done. Or if you just had one job you're working on, you know, I spoke to some artists that had 90% of their work dry up. So then what do you do? It makes it a little bit more difficult when nobody's ringing the door looking for work, so.
Well, that's the thing, right? That's the thing about architecture. It's like, you know, during a time of uncertainty, the first thing your company is going to do is going to stop spending money. And that means stop building anything new. So that means no more job for architects. And if the architects aren't building anything new, they certainly don't need any renderings of those
Of new
things, right?
stuff, yeah. I sat in on a conference call with four of the top developers in New York, and it was interesting. I mean, at least this is, of course, you know, the upper echelons of architecture, and of where billions and billions of are being spent. And you know, there are people in our industry that cater to that market, and you know, they're at the time they're feeling this was back in, I guess, March or mid-April or so. They were saying, you know, look, we'll just hold off till September. You know, there's no rush for us to build today. We'll do it in September. And if they're holding, then that means that hold period trickles down to everybody else. So,
Yeah, you gotta if you shut off the fire hose of money.
Yeah, exactly.
Then
yeah.
No one's gonna get it. Yeah, exactly. Of course. So. Yeah, it's like, yeah, we're gonna save some water. No one's drinking. You know, it's like it's a thing. Well, that's it's true. But I'm also wondering, like, in general, you know, as we mentioned, like, there is a lot of businesses out there that are suddenly saying, maybe our employees can continue to work from home indefinitely. I know, like, Twitter has famously said that they said, you know, if you want to continue to work from home, you can. I just read an article that REI built this brand new high tech headquarters, and now they're like, I don't think we need it, and they're going to sell it.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. So, like, okay. And so suddenly, like, the entire real estate market is kind of going to take an interesting change in events, especially commercial real estate.
My thought on that early on was that I didn't think people, even there might be some, but I didn't think anybody was going to get rid of their offices. But I thought it opened the door to being able to scale down the size of your offices, because not everybody needed to be in the office all the time. You know, you could rotate in and out, maybe come into the office 1, 2, 3 days a week, and then work from home the rest. And then if that's the case, you know, companies could really be cutting down their,
their footprint.
Rental fees. Yeah.
Yeah. And commercial real estate can be really expensive depending on where you are. Right. So if you're living in, you know, Boston or whatever, Boston's very expensive, right? And if you can say, I'm going to take my office and cut it in half, that's a huge savings. And then just totally. Say, you know, only half the office comes in at a time. So that's, interesting. All right. Well, so that's weird. We got sidetracked, not about the site anymore. Okay. So there's some other cool stuff that you have on your site that I was looking at too. What was it? There was, tell us some of the other features.
So one of the things that was problematic in the past, we allowed people to add keywords, but of course nobody wants to add keywords. So we automated all of that. So now when you upload images, we have three different AIs that analyze every image and automatically assign keywords and tags to them so that people can search based on those.
Right. That's pretty good as well. But you still have a lot of the other things that you used to have. For example, you still have your awards, right?
Yeah, the awards are still around. The content is still around. All of the images, the gallery are still around. Our forums for now are still around. So, right. And I mean, all of the stuff that we had before didn't go away. We just added a bunch of stuff on top, make it a little bit easier. The one thing that we did add as well that, you know, is it's really been interesting. In the past, people wanted to create content or articles or making ofs and that sort of thing. You know, if they wanted to do that, they would have to reach out to us. They'd have to send us a Word document and the images, and then we'd have to format it. We built this whole thing called a visual storyteller tool. Basically allows you to create content. And by default, it's locked to your profile. But we get notifications of all of the content as it comes in. And when we see good stuff, we're able to push it to the front end right away so that everybody can see that content. So really people can start using CG Architect as a publishing platform for, you know, if you're a software hardware provider, it can be, you know, press releases or information about new products. Or if you're a visualization studio, it can be a making of, or, you know, your manifesto about something that's going on in the industry about copyright or something like that. And now you're able to publish that and get the exposure.
Yeah. That's very
it's like a medium.
Yeah. Which is really cool. You know, a little bit of, you know, Redditness to it, I guess.
Somewhat.
Let's talk a little bit about the awards, because I mean, this has been around. How long have the awards been around?
I think this is 17 years now.
17 years of So it's like the Oscars for ArcViz, for sure. Now, this is also a really good. I mean, your AI tool. Is that going to be leveraged for your awards?
Yes and no. Okay. No, in that, you know, we're not replacing any judges with AI. Yes, in that this year, once we figure out who the winners are, I'm actually going to push the submissions through an AI and see how well
your AI would do.
Yeah, exactly. So if we get all the nominees, I'm going to feed that to the AI and I'm going to get its input and we'll do it.
So you're still going to do the traditional way of doing things.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it would take some programming to do it, which is why, you know, we haven't done it, but it would be interesting to have a judge as an AI.
Yes,
so it would be averaged in. Exactly, it would be averaged into the system. So I would be curious to see if it could pull out the winners.
Do you think? I mean, obviously, and this is you've done an incredible job of keeping the competition as good and as fair as possible. I know this because it's been around for 17 years. But you've also met with a lot of challenges of people questioning whether this is worthy of this or does this fit the requirements of that. And it's really challenging because obviously the prizes involve a lot of money, and they feel if people feel unfairly treated, then they feel like they were, you know, duped out of the money. How have you managed that over the years? I mean, that's really hard.
Yeah, I mean, our rules now look like a contest sweepstakes fine print document as a result of that. In the beginning, you know, it was really just, you know, submit an image or a film and, you know, best person.
Maybe you'll win.
Won. Yeah, exactly. It was really that simple. It's funny, there were other competitions in the industry in the past, and, you know, they kind of commented on, like, you know, our competition is simple, we don't need all these rules and stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, those rules exist because of all the problems that you will run into when you have an awards that have longevity.
Right.
But yeah, no, it's problematic because, especially in recent years, you know, our prize pool has been anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000. I think one year we got almost up to $600,000 in prizes. So the impetus to try to find loopholes or to cheat is huge. And not so much, I would say, to win the prizes, but because of the impact winning or being nominated can have on a career. There's very few people I've spoken to that, you know, say we weren't already established in the industry. If they were new to the industry, last year's D2, it was somewhat humbling to have all these people come on stage and talk about how, you know, being nominated or winning literally changed their career. You know, it launched their career in some cases. So the impetus to try to win is huge. And in the last couple of years, as a result of that, we kind of released this pre-nomination phase, right? So we will have the tentative nominees that we'll announce, and they will be sort of sit into the public sphere for, I think this year or 3 weeks. I think last year, I think I had 4 or 5 weeks just because we had the award ceremony. But the intent is for everybody to be able to see them, because anytime we get reports on images that, you know, have tried to skirt the rules, it always comes from people in the industry letting us know. There's no possible way for me to do checks on all of these things. So we very much rely on the industry to do it. So we put these tentative nominees out. And
this could be things like, oh, this is a ripoff of another rendering, or this is whatever.
Or this person didn't go to school, or this person worked professionally when they say they were a student.
Because of the category they were doing.
Yeah, yep. Exactly. So there's two things. We rely on the industry to point out things, you know, in confidence to us. But also it allows us to do, you know, sounds a little bit big brotherish, but we actually do background checks when we get the nominees, because the impacts are so big, we can't not do this now.
Right.
If we had 1 year where there was a perception that the winner shouldn't have won, 17 years goes down the drain like that.
Right.
So now the nominees, and we spend a month doing background checks on people. Last year I had a team of 10 people combing social media, contacting people that know these people and asking questions about, you know, the work that they've done and where, when they went to school, and, like, you know, but not in a way where they know why they're being asked. It's just innocent questions. So, yeah, I think if people think they can get past the system now, it's, you know, it's not impossible, but, you know, the bar has been raised significantly to try to get around our rules.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not fair if someone, you know, professional enters into the student competition and is like, you know, that's not fair, obviously. I remember there was a lot of weird things, like unexpected things, like Weta entered for King Kong thing as a CG architect. That was a weird year.
So that was probably in the beginning the biggest negativity, and that one kind of epitomized the bigger problem, but that wasn't the only issue. And the core of the issue was, is it fair to pit commissioned versus non-commissioned work against each other?
Right.
When somebody has 6 months and no constraints versus 2 weeks and all of the constraints that come with it working for a client, is it fair to put those together? Can you ever compare them? Because they're not the same. And as soon as we broke all of our categories into the commissioned and non-commissioned, it almost removed like 90% of the negativity that we got in the early days. So I think that was probably the single biggest rule change that we made that helped things out.
Yeah, because I think I remember one of the first ones, and this is something I was a judge on years and years ago, this when Paul Nichols was did his submission, and it was very abstract, shall we say. It was definitely very architectural.
Very Bartlett, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's very abstract and very Bartlett, as you mentioned, but it was, everyone's like, well, I submitted something that's real architecture.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, but I think it was really good. And it's still an important part of the architecture and design process. So I actually highly voted for, I was 100% behind Paul's submission, but it was interesting that some people are just can't see that. When I was at Gensler years and years ago, there was a designer there who was, specialized, shall we say, in, office park designs.
Yep.
Very boring office park designs.
Right.
Zaha Hadid would come by and done a lecture, and he was like, that's not real architecture. That's sculpture, and that's under the disguise of being architecture. I was like, I think it's architecture. I think that you're not seeing outside the peak capabilities of what's going on. So I think it's an interesting thing. And I think I really like the fact that CG Architect does those controversies. Actually are awesome because it brings you to question certain things of what it is and what it isn't, and what does it represent, and what's good, and once if my immediate reaction, if people are angry about something being a good representation, not a good, that's immediately a sign that that's a good thing.
Well, I mean, it's frustrating when you get a lot of this negativity over the years. I mean, I've had physical threats of violence, if you can believe it, over the 3D Awards. Yeah. But, on one hand, it's like, really? On the other hand, it's like, if the importance of the awards are such that people feel compelled to threaten you, it obviously means we're doing something right, otherwise they wouldn't care.
Right.
So is horrible as that is, and that's like, a 1%. I mean, the other 90%, 99% of negative feedback is just, often helpful criticism that we take on board. And it's the reason that our rules are as long as they are, because, we've taken on board all the feedback and criticism over the years and adapted with it. So.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty interesting. I think I couldn't manage it the way you do. I think I would get very frustrated. I'd love being a judge, by the way. It's a lot of fun being a judge, but managing all of that, the politics behind it is you're doing it an incredible job of that. And so I applaud you for that for sure.
Yeah.
What are some of the things you think that CG Architect is going to do in the future? Like, where do you want to go from here? Obviously, you've built this platform. It's going to keep evolving, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, I mean, from a surface point of view, I mean, it's a tool that, artists can use like they've always used, and that's kind of what they, have come to know it for. Mm-hmm. On the back end, though, I mean, the whole back end platform was really being built in a way to collect all of the information and data, as bad as data collection of a reputation as it has, thanks to companies like Google and Facebook and whatnot. But taking all of this information together in one spot is really powerful, and it is going to allow us to do some really interesting tools based on that data in the future. So a lot of the infrastructure that is in place now is based on knowing that the power of all of this industry data will be able to be used to build tools for people in the industry. And I mean, you could have people that go like, oh, that's a horrible thing. CG Architect's going to become this big, horrible machine that's going to abuse our data. I mean, I would hope that, anybody that knows me knows that that's probably the last thing on earth I would ever do. So.
Yeah. But, the thing is, everyone keeps saying, all these awesome benefits that they're getting from these tools. And the only way they're able to do that is because those tools are developed based on a lot of data.
Yeah. Well,
so,
yeah.
So well, otherwise.
But yeah. I think, but I think all of those, well, I mean, I guess you could argue CG Architect could go down the same path, but I mean, in the beginning,
Right.
I don't think anybody started those tools with the intent of trying to do something,
Right.
against the users, but they've evolved that way, probably because a
Right.
lot more people are involved in the decision making than just the owners of those companies in the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, right? A lot of people get very upset about, like, oh no, like I'm going to a website and suddenly now all my ads are about the things that I've been researching. And I'm like, well, I'd rather have ads about things I'm interested in than ads of things that I'm not interested in. You know?
That's
So.
the tricky thing about, I mean, in social media is no different. It's the tricky thing about community. We've really all of these tools, social media and the internet, have all really trained people to think that everything is free.
Yeah, no,
We
it's
don't
not.
need to pay for anything. We don't need to give up anything to get it. Everything should just be handed to us on a silver platter. And as somebody who runs a community site, that can be incredibly frustrating when
Right.
that is the prevailing opinion of many people. So then you're forced to do things and I suspect that that's why Facebook has done what it's done. They probably
Right.
tried, if they came out and said like, oh, you can pay $250 a year for Facebook, they probably lose 95% of their followers, right? So how now all of a
Probably
sudden they have to
99.5%.
yeah, there you go. There you go. So
Yeah.
then you're forced to go down these paths, not
And the
that
whole
I
point of
say that
Facebook is
we
that everyone's on it, right? So,
exactly. So
well, it's interesting, because the alternative, right, is tons of ads. So, like, we recently, like, we don't have TV in our house. And we went to an Airbnb not long ago, and there was a TV there. I haven't watched street TV in a long time, and I realized, oh my God, street TV is horrible. Like the amount of ads that are on TV constantly. And the reason there's so many ads is because they have to sort of,
there's no other way to support the platform,
they well, not only that, but they don't know who their audience is, so they're just going to throw more ads to hopefully get you an ad that you want to
I
see.
remember as a kid, they used to send out, and I used to get $1. So, I mean, my parents were not so interested in this, but for me, I
Right.
was like, $1, wow, that's amazing. But they would send you this form, and it was huge. It was like 30 pages long. And every day, you had to write down what TV shows you wrote, or sorry, you
Right.
watched, and you'd fill this out, and then you'd mail it in. And I think it was like Nielsen or somebody
Yeah,
along those lines
Nielsen.
that did
Yeah.
it. So that was how. That's how TV. I suspect it's probably very similar. I mean, I'm guessing that the cable boxes have a little bit more intelligence to tell what people are watching now, but.
Oh, well, no, actually, this is the scarier thing. I'm sorry to tell you this and to the users, but the reason TVs are as cheap as they are, because nowadays, like TCL, which is a TV brand, you can get a 65-inch 4K HDR, high-quality HDR TV, like really good 4K HDR, for $600.
So they're obviously collecting something there then.
So what they're doing is they're literally looking at your screen and what you're looking at. It's kind of like what's it called?
Oh,
What's
so they're
the?
doing eye tracking of some
They're,
sort with the.
They're not eye tracking you. They're looking at what's on your screen. So it's kind of
Ah,
like
I see.
Shazam or whatever that thing is, but a visual version of it. And then they're sending that back to data
Interesting.
so they know who you are.
Well, they can probably tell now how much of a commercial will you watch before you hit the fast forward button,
Oh
and
yeah, totally. Yeah.
and when you press stop, did you get it just right, or did you miss the last 2 seconds? In which case, we can squeeze an ad in there so you actually see it,
Right. So there's a lot of things that are going on. That's why TVs sell huge amounts of data. And that's the only way, because their profit margins. I mean, I actually had an interesting conversation, listened to a podcast with the CEO of Vizio, and he goes, like, listen, he's like, we make like 1 to 2% profit on TVs. It's like it's all the services that we make all the money on. And the services is selling data to people so that they know what's in that household. Yeah. So, yep.
I mean,
Right now.
it all comes down to what are people comfortable giving up to get, what
Right.
they,
And that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying that, I'm not actually don't really want to have an opinion on this. I think, people need to be aware of what's being
going with out with the exchanges. There. What is the exchange?
Yeah. Things aren't for free. In fact, sometimes people would rather keep it free because they make more money selling your data than they do actually getting money from you directly.
Yeah.
So paying $30 for a game, they're not making as much money as selling your data.
And maybe just to back up so that there's no misconception about this or CG Architect specifically. When I say using data to build tools, I don't mean selling the data to some third party. I mean,
you want to use the data to further your intelligence of your thing or whatever.
I mean, I'll give a good example. So one of the interesting things that came up is if these tools are really good on the front end for data that you want to present to the industry, mm-hmm. those same tools could be used on the back end as a CRM of sorts for your internal data, or DAM, it's actually not a CRM,
right.
a digital asset manager. So if these tools are really good on the front end, you could use that same data and all of the intelligence that we've learned from, you know, the tagging and what's good and whatnot. Now, all of a sudden, you can use that on the back end in your studio that's not exposed to the internet in any way. But now that data could be turned into a tool that you could use in-house.
Right.
So,
and you can evaluate your own work using the same tools that CG Architect website does. Yeah.
Well, and there's a big need for, we're in talks now with a partner to do this. Might take a little bit of time, wait for COVID to end, but almost all of the data in our industry is organized by flat file structure, but mm-hmm. there's no real intelligent way to find information. And when you have thousands and thousands of images, it's really difficult to know where things are. You know, if you're new to the company or if you want to reference something historical, there's much better ways to do that. And a lot of the stuff that we've been working on the front end really lends itself well to being able to find data, you know, historical data within your own studios as well.
Right. Well, I think that's great. I think it's really great that you've done that. But I think it's also, you know, really interesting, you know, how you managed to do this, because it must have been a big struggle. Like, you're right, the AI is really important because it must have been a real struggle to go through all that data. And it didn't allow you to basically have as many images or have as much content go up, right, onto your site and sort of make it something that people want to go to, right? Because they see it as like, that looks really cool, you know?
Well, what was interesting, you know, kind of in my original research, I had found some research that had done what we were doing, but with photographic content. And I thought, perfect, I'll be able to leverage all this existing, you know, systems and tools, and I won't have to do any, development myself. Right. What was interesting is even though ArcViz images are photographic in nature and often, you know, the average layperson wouldn't be able to discern them from a photograph. Mm-hmm. When you fed these images to an AI trained on photographs, also mm-hmm. of architecture, it didn't work. It got it wrong like 90% of the time.
Interesting.
And because there's enough nuance between a CG image and a photograph of architecture that it didn't work. So it was really, and this is, I think, you know, our power. And again, going back to the data, is that we have this 19-year repository of ArcViz images. There's a ton of cool stuff you can do with that, and nobody else has that. So how do we leverage all of the community's information to give them tools like we just, you know, did with being able to show them the best work in the industry? So
yeah,
I think but there's no other way to do that unless you have the data. And I think, you know, all of these AIs all rely on data.
You know, it's interesting. We should go back to, like, I think I'll put it in the show links, but you should go back to an episode you and I recorded, it must have been like 4 years ago at GTC.
Yeah,
where you and I were there and we were talking about, like, you know, VR is going one way, but we really think that AI and deep learning is the future of what's going to be used. And I was like, and here we are. You've built your site based on
you
it.
Know, and honestly, at the time, the techniques were around, but they were very much in academia. I mean, back even 4 years ago, I wouldn't have known been able to do what we did.
Right.
So it's evolved so much so quickly. So,
It's approachable now. Like you can do it, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're even seeing mainstream tools today, even the production tools, very, you know, very small little dabblings here and there that are using AI in production right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's a whole talk that I did the last, not last year, but 2 years previous, that was all on AI, and all of it was research that came out of academia, and there is literally AI development being done in every single phase of the production pipeline in 3D.
Interesting.
So I think it'll be
Yeah.
interesting to see where we go with this. I think in time it won't be impossible for us to be able to generate images based on spoken words or text
Right.
or a set of criteria.
Yeah. So rendering
Yeah.
will be AI rendering.
I think so. I think the cool part is, will the AI be, will the image synthesis be done in 2D or will it be done in 3D?
Right. Could be
Yeah.
either one. I mean,
Do
AI.
we just mash a bunch of images together
Yeah.
and it
I
create?
mean, the problem is always, right, Jeff, is that this is the thing, is that the AI, specifically in deep learning or machine learning, it's all based on what it already knows. So
Yeah, for now, yeah.
it's never really going to be inspirational because
Yeah.
it's based on what it already
Yeah.
understands. So it's never going to
So,
do something that's comes out of nowhere. That has to be from someone who's like,
yeah,
bing, you know.
and I don't think this question came up a lot when I would do the talks is, what does this do to creativity? But I think if you look at what is the scope of our industry, what does it do? If you consider visualization to be everything from a screenshot out of SketchUp to, a $10,000 image, if that's the scope of visualization, at least 80% of it just has to be good enough. It's purely representational. It's not inspirational. It's not, creative in any way. So if that's the case, that whole 80, 90% is ripe for automation in some way, shape, or form.
For sure, for sure. I mean, it's, you're still looking at images. You're still checking, to see the quality control of your AI, like dipping the up, still tastes good.
I think for the very much the foreseeable future, and I don't think this is happening anytime soon, but I think the first tools are what we see now, things like denoisers and those types of tools. I think the next step are tools that, maybe help generate a portion of the image. It's maybe it sets up a camera for us and then we can tweak it, or it sets up some lighting for us and we can tweak it. It just sort of gets us there, but we're still allowed to give the creative feedback, but we don't have to do all the drudgery that got us to that point where we spend the last 10% really
Well, I
making it
think
special.
that there's, I mean, there's definitely AI tools, for example, that are being used, for example, in fluid simulation, right? So in fluid simulation, it's a very complicated thing, but it's also very chaotic, right? So
Yeah.
if you're like, here's some conditions, and then what the AI is going to do is like, well, based on having seen, hundreds of thousands of simulations, my guess is going to be
Yeah.
this. And it won't be accurate, but it'll look good,
Yep.
right? And
Yep.
it'll look about what you think it should look like.
Yep.
And so therefore, and it'll do it, at 1,000 times faster than it's been able to do it before, because it doesn't actually have to do the calculations.
Well,
So,
to your earlier points in the podcast here about the ArcVis industry, and this is what you're alluding to, being very self-referential.
Right.
If that's the case, well, okay, so then really what is the scope of work that really needs to be created? It's not that big.
But you do need someone to pop up, right? And you need an Alex Roman to come up and say, let's change the game.
I mean, I've been thinking about, and this would require massive data collection, but it would be very interesting. Let's just say you could collect every single metric and data point on the entire cycle of architecture from conception to the sale of it, and let's just say the context of skyscraper residential. If you were to know the color of brochures that were used, the days they went out, who purchased, the demographic of who purchased, how much they paid, how long it took. I mean, just think of any single metric you could possibly think of. If you could collect all of that, you in theory would be able to say, oh, you want to build a 80-story skyscraper with this price point? Oh, you need to do Twitter ads on Wednesdays at 8:35 p.m. with green in the upper right-hand corner because that's going to push your sales 1.2% more and you're going to sell it out faster. All of these
Or
things have.
better yet, you like it's like the only thing you need is a Twitter ad. And then you don't have to pay for all the other stuff that is so expensive that,
So, I mean, I think I mean, this is, pie in the sky right now, but imagine if, in creating your visuals, it's not just about what you feel it should look like. It's data tells you that you need to have this composition, you need to have this lighting and this mood in order to sell this architecture to this demographic.
And if you don't think that's not happening, it is happening.
Yeah.
You get your ads at a very specific time on Facebook because of that algorithm that someone has created. So
very but I think that's where we're, you know, long term, I think that's where our industry goes.
Yeah. And I don't think you're not doing that. You're not necessarily doing that at all on CG Architect, but I do think it's important that people know that data is very powerful, and it helps build tools that can definitely help them as well, right? So especially recruiters, if they want to look for something, they have the tool and they can use your data, which is, you know, or they can use your AI, which is fed by your data.
Exactly.
To make that work. So there you go.
Self-referential.
Well, this is awesome. Listen, we've gone over an hour, but this has been really cool. And I really highly encourage people to go check out the new CG Architect if you haven't done it in a while. Really cool stuff. The content on there is absolutely gorgeous. Curated by a wonderful AI system that Jeff has designed over the years. And it's a really great site and a really good tool for both people who want to post work as well as people who want to find people who are looking for work. So a really great idea. Also great articles, as you mentioned, and you've got a review section. If you've got really good work, the 3D Awards or the CG Architect Awards are also a really good place. When is that starting? That's got to be starting pretty soon, right?
Yeah, we're 1 month into the call for submission. So I think next week will be 1 month left.
Okay, well, hopefully this podcast comes out before then. It may not, but if it doesn't, then you'll be able to check out the winners, which will be announced sometime. When are the winners?
Yeah, normally we host the award ceremony at D2, but just obviously due to COVID, schedules didn't sync up. So we will have the nominees and winners announced in the fall.
In the fall. Okay, perfect. Yeah. So then you can definitely check that out. All right, Jeff, thanks so much for doing this. It's been great.
You've
been
like
five times on.
I know. Do I get one of those like gold plaques? You know,
that you should. Like a million YouTube subscribers.
Yeah, exactly. Things.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly. When you get to five shows, you get the silver, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Thanks, man.
Thanks a lot.